Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Yolele, the revolutionary African foods company. Learn more at yolele.com.
This week's episode of Meat in 3 is inspired by the reemergence of Cicada Brood 10. We're talking all about insects.
Some people are calling crickets the gateway bug because that's a great introduction to what edible insects is all about.
So we found detectable levels of cesium-137 in 68 of 122 total honey samples that we had.
What is that?
Is it a tarantula?
No, what is it?
It's a tarantula.
Oh, and they're going to eat it? No, 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 no.
Listen to Meat in 3 wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Feast Meets West, the show celebrating Asian cuisine and culture as we have conversations with the passionate people from the world of Asian food. I'm your host, Linda Liu. I recently spoke with the internationally renowned cookbook author and food writer, Hetty McKinnon, about her latest cookbook, To Asia With Love. You may know her from her previous three best-selling cookbooks, including Community, Salad Recipes from Arthur Street Kitchen, Neighborhood, Salad Sweets and Stories from Home and Abroad, and the award-winning Family, New Vegetarian Comfort Food to Nourish Every Day. Or you may know Hetty from her many recipe contributions to New York Times Cooking, Epicurious, ABC Life, Food and Wine, and The Guardian. A true force to be reckoned with, she is also the editor and publisher of multicultural food journal Peddler and the host of the magazine's podcast, The House Specials. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Hetty. Welcome, Hetty. Thanks so much for joining me on the podcast.
Hey, Linda. Thanks for having me. I'm thrilled.
Yeah. Firstly, I just want to say how hungry I got reading through your book. I want to make and eat everything in it. And it might be because I actually have a similar cultural background to you in the sense that my parents are Chinese, but I grew up in a Western environment here in the States. Mm-hmm. So your recipes in To Asia With Love that are Asian-ish, but it has your spin on it, they just really resonate with my taste buds.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, I've heard that a lot, actually. Yeah, it's I really have spoken to a lot of people who have said to me, wow, I can't believe I'm seeing like that soy dan, that steamed water egg custard in a cookbook. Like that's something that my grandmother made for me when I was growing up and she died and I thought I'd never eat it again. And stories like that, I mean, I think that that's one of the really special things about this book has really been connecting with other people like me who had similar upbringings. And, you know, it's something that I feel like I didn't have a lot of connection with when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. So it's a real thrill to have that now through this book.
Yeah. Could you tell us more about your upbringing? So mm-hmm. Where did you grow up? Where's your family from?
Yep. So as you can hear, I have an Australian accent.
I love it. It's adorable.
I grew up, I was born and raised in Sydney. My parents had come to and immigrated from to Australia from the Guangdong province in southern China. They were from the same village, and they had come to Australia. My dad first, actually, my dad in his teens came to study, and my mum followed kind of in her early 20s. And it was kind of on the precipice of the Cultural Revolution, and that's one of the things that. You know, I think you might agree, coming from a similar background, is, you know, the story of the old country is one that's very hard to get from your parents. And I don't know a lot about their upbringing in China, but I know from my mum that it was hard, and it was, you know, there was a lot of, there was food rationings, and, you know, they all lived together, and it was like they all really wanted to get out, and a lot of them went to Hong Kong. Her passage to Australia was through, you know, she lived in Hong Kong for a few years. Some of her aunts still lived there, and, you know, she waited until she could get to Australia. So anyway, they get to Australia, and my parents got married in Sydney, and my dad, you know, bought this little house in the suburbs. And yeah, I was born there, and I grew up there in the 80s. And it was, you know, it right now, you know, now, you know, Australia is such a multicultural country. You know, there's a real melting pot with a huge bias towards Asian immigrants, probably. And we were like the newer wave at the time. And I grew up in a very multicultural neighborhood, but not that many Asians. You know, there were like three or four Asian Chinese families on our street, and we were all related. You know, it was my aunts next door, or actually on both sides, they were my dad's, and one was my dad's cousin and one was my dad's sister, and then his other sister and his first mother. There were two mothers in my dad's family. And the first mother lived in on the corner. So you know, it was a very interesting time, because I remember when I was growing up, you know, my mum's very traditional and really never learned to speak English, still doesn't. I mean, she's lived in Australia for 50 years, but she
So you speak Chinese with her?
I speak Cantonese. We speak, like, we're from Zhongshan, so I speak a very small, you know, the Zhongshan dialect, and, you know, not that well anymore, to be honest, but, you know, enough that I speak to my mum in Chinese, and she calls still every week. So, but yeah,
you're a good daughter.
I know. We had to, you know, Linda. It was really there was no choice. So it's something I'm grateful for now. But at the time, it was like, oh, I just wanted to speak English, you know. But yeah, growing up, we spoke Cantonese at home. We ate Cantonese food. My mum was very traditional. She really didn't really assimilate to living in Australia at all. And so that was my life at home. And then, you know, I went to school and I wanted to be Australian, like desperately wanted to be Australian and desperately wanted to be like everyone else and just to blend in. And I didn't want to do anything to bring attention to the fact that I was different. And that's something, you know, you could probably relate to, and lots of children of immigrants can relate to. So, you know, it was a happy upbringing, but, you know, it was I felt very Chinese, but I felt like I really wanted to be somebody else a lot of the time, or I didn't know who I was a lot of the time, perhaps. And yeah, so it was like, you know, growing up Chinese in a Western country, there's a lot of influences. You are just, you know, subjected to a lot of influences, and so you kind of feel like you're always stuck in the middle. And I feel like for most of my life, I think I really was probably not embracing my Chineseness as much as I could have. Like, I know with a lot of my mum's friends, their kids were like going to Chinese school and doing, kind of following more of a path that I thought was typical of, you know, Chinese kids. I don't know what that is, but, you know, they had piano lessons and I just refused to do all of that stuff. But yeah, I mean, I feel like that part of the growing up in Australia was in the 80s, when it was probably not as open as it is now. But yeah, I just feel like I didn't really touch upon or really connect with my cultural identity, if I'm going to be completely honest. I don't feel like I connected with my cultural identity until I started cooking, which was in my 30s, you know, like cooking professionally. So yeah, it's been a long road, and I guess, you know, a lot of To Asia with Love is about that journey.
Mm-hmm. I love that. So I actually had first become acquainted with your work in the last few years when I saw your mm-hmm. recipe contributions to like the New York Times and Bon Appetit. Mm-hmm. And then I read up more about you. I discovered your inspiring and very influential business, Arthur Street Kitchen in Sydney. Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about that and how you transitioned into food?
Yeah, so it was really by accident. I mean, I was, I did that the normal path. You know, went to school, went to university in Sydney, studied to be in PR, worked in PR for many years. Was in living in London, and then my husband and I were in London in the early 2000s, and I had my first child there, and then I just felt this incredible, overwhelming calling to go back to Sydney to be with my mum, really. And so we moved back, and then I had two other kids in quick succession. So I have three children. And
kudos when my to son, you.
Yeah, I know. It was like those years were a blur, to be completely honest. And I don't think I could have gotten through them without my mum, like basically, you know, helping me every day.
Yeah.
But I think that was a real turning point for me, like having children. And then being back in Sydney, I lived in this wonderful little inner city community, and I just loved being at home. And that's like something I never expected that I would say, like having, you know, really worked hard as a younger person to leave home and to go off and do all these things. I just had this, I just wanted to be at home. I wanted to cook. It was really weird, and I liked food. Obviously, I'd been surrounded by food my entire life, and every memory of my mother is of her cooking. So food was always a part of my life, but I didn't think I wanted to make it my career. You know, like that's something very different. But I got to the point, my youngest son was about one at the time, and I started getting these offers to go back to work full, like part-time and go PR offers. And I really just didn't want to do it. And I thought to myself, what can I do to like have an excuse to stay at home? So I thought, wow, I really love like make, I'd love to share like the foods that I'm cooking at home. Because I've also been vegetarian for 20 something years since I was a teenager. So, we ate like kind of these big salads, lots of vegetables. And I liked cooking that at home. So I thought, oh, why don't I just, you know, but like kind of put these in a box and cycle them around the neighborhood. So that was kind of the genesis of Arthur Street Kitchen, which had no business plan, no intentions other than really just cooking for the community. And that's what I really wanted. Like it was never, I mean, I used the word business. It didn't really even feel like a business because it was also makeshift. You know, I cooked from home. I did like registered my kitchen as a home kitchen, which you can do in Sydney. You can't do that in New York, of course. So I just started cooking, and I think, and it really, I really wanted to do an anti-PR things. I didn't promote it at all. I just, you know, I think I made like these little postcards. I mean, this was in 2011, so it really wasn't even that long ago, but it was really pre-social media. I made these little postcards and dropped them around the neighborhood. And the first week, I think I had four orders. Three of them were my friends, and one was from a real estate company like up on like around the corner from my house. And you know, it was really quick. Like people ordered the food and they started telling each other about it. And soon I was like delivering 80 salads a day, all on my own, on my bike. I was really learning to cook while I was running that business. You know, while every week I cooked, I only did it twice a week. So Thursdays and Fridays, I would send out a menu on a Wednesday. By email, like no apps, like nothing fancy. And then I would sit there and write down orders in a notebook. I still probably have those notebooks of every order that was ever taken. And then I would, you know, cook everything at home, box everything myself, and deliver them myself. And it was just, it became like this magical, magical time because I was meeting people. I was, you know, having these amazing conversations on doorsteps and on street corners. And I just saw the new strangers became friends, and they're still my friends. They're still very dear friends of mine. And so it was like this connection, you know, this amazing connection over an exchange of a salad box that became to mean everything to me, you know, like I never would have imagined that cooking would bring so much to me on a personal level. And during this time, my mum was with me. Like every day I was cooking, she would come and kind of like babysit my youngest son.
That's great bonding.
It is. And while she was there babysitting, you know, she was such a, she's just a typical Chinese mum. She'd be doing everything else while she was babysitting. She would be helping me chop vegetables, washing the vegetables, you know, telling me how to do things and telling me what I was doing wrong, which was a lot of things, obviously. And she, we would just be in the kitchen talking. She would like, and it was just like this wonderful time for me where I saw a real different side of my mum, like other than just being my mom. It was just like, well, I was then a mom, and we kind of like were just kind of, we were
sounds
together.
Sounds like she was your partner.
Kind of, yeah, like unofficially my partner. And she was also like discovering a lot about food from me at that time, because I was not really cooking Asian salads. They were like, you know, lots of different inspirations, but a lot of Middle Eastern stuff. I used a lot of spices in my cooking. And so she was also discovering a lot about food at that time. So it was just this amazing kind of give and take situation. And it really made me think about food, A, food and the impact it had had on my life and that it can have on other people's lives. And I guess, you know, the journey over the years has been seeing, you know, really looking at the role food has played in my life and that connection, the connection that I had with the locals of my community was, is kind of like the connection that I had with my, my heritage and my mum. But like the food was all, food was such a bridge, you know, for me it was, has always been a bridge to building understanding between people and between places and between cultures. And so I guess that feeling of connection has really underscored all the work that I do in food up until this very day.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. And did that end up leading to a couple book deals in Sydney?
Well, yeah. So the funny thing is I was cooking and, as I said, you know, I was learning about food as I was cooking for my community. And a couple of years after after I started the business, I started getting these, like, people would email me saying, oh, you know, I really want to make that carrot salad for my friend this weekend. Can you send me the recipe? And so I was like, oh, wow, I don't really have a recipe. So I started writing down some recipes and emailing them. These were two of my customers and just sharing that way. And there was this one week when I was out delivering salads when three different customers said to me, you know, you should really write a book. And really that was the first time it had really dawned on me that these recipes could be written down into a collection. So I did that. And in 2013, I self-published my first book called Community, and I was, it was really only made for the people of my community. I never expected it to be anything. Really, I did not expect it to be anything. And I printed 1,000 copies because that was the minimum print run. And I started, you know, and I put it on my website or something. And little did I know, like in 3 weeks, it sold out, like 1,000 copies. And I was mailing them out. Like I'd be, you know, I was doing, it was all mail order. And it was like this strangest thing. I was like, why are people buying this book? Like this is like, this is weird because it was written, you know, very much about my business. And the recipes were just the recipes I was serving up. So it was a really strange experience. And then I had all these back orders and I was about to reprint my second, you know, like the next more to fulfill all these orders that I had that I didn't have enough books for. And then, you know, serendipity has really, you know, been a huge part of my career in food, actually, because literally on the day I was about to approve the second print run, I got a phone call out of the blue from a woman called Mary Small, and she, it turned out, worked at a publisher's and had seen my book at her friend's house. And her friend was not even someone I really knew, but he shared an office with one of my customers, and he had seen the book and he'd taken it home to have a look at. And whilst this Mary was at his house, she saw the book, wanted it, and then apparently had pitched it to her company even before she'd even spoken to me. So by the time I got that phone call, it was already a done deal in her head. Like, she had pitched it, they wanted to publish the book, it had already been approved. And it was basically like, we want to publish your book nationally. So I was like, okay, all right. You've just saved me from having to print more books and being.
Talk about the power of community.
Exactly. And it's like, it's really one of those things. And so when the book came out, was released nationally by Pan Macmillan in Australia only, it was launched around Mother's Day 2014, so around May 2014. And it was then, again, the power of community that really launched that book. I didn't really do any press. I mean, I wasn't well known in Australia at the time. And it was really the people who took that book and started sharing it with their friends, their families. Amazing stories I've heard about people forming their own little WhatsApp groups, and they're sending photos of, you know, the meals from community to one another. And people were creating their own communities around this book, which was really such a phenomenal thing to witness and to even hear about, because a lot of the times I didn't even know about what was going on with that book. And so that was the same year that I actually left Australia. So a few months later, my husband was offered an opportunity to move to New York for his work, and my business was getting hard at the time because the book had come out. I was getting a lot of attention, and people really wanted a part of it. They wanted to order, and I just didn't want the business to grow. I really just always wanted to keep it small and for my community. Right. And it was really hard with all this attention and all this demand. So I thought, hey, I could do this again in Brooklyn. I could start from scratch and rebuild this business in a different city. So when the offer came to move to New York, I jumped at it. I was like, yes, you know, I can do this again, because my passion is really not in having a huge business, but it's in feeding people, like that real one-on-one contact. That's what I really craved and wanted. So we came to New York, and at the time I was offered by my publishers in Australia to write the second book, which is called Neighborhood. And I'd said to them, yes, I'll do the book, but I don't want to do it till I get to New York, because I really wanted the move and the changes to really inform the book. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did. I mean, we traveled for a couple of months before we arrived in New York in January of 2015. And it was one of the coldest winters in New York for a very long time. It was a real shock to me, actually, because, you know, having grown up in Sydney where it's kind of nice all year round. And I wrote this book, you know, it kind of poured out of me in 3 months. And the book is another salad book. So it was kind of like a follow-up to Community. Mm-hmm. But it's about kind of embracing flavors from around the world and kind of embracing those ingredients and letting that kind of influence the what you cook and the way you eat. And that's really kind of, and even though I did have aspirations to cook after I moved to Brooklyn, I did do the delivery business for about 6 months. Mm-hmm. I did pop-ups. I had a studio for a while where I did pop-ups and, you know, kind of rented it out to other people. It's funny because I ended up really writing about food. Like, that's kind of what brought me here. Like, it's being in a different city. It really made me, it changed the way I looked at food. It changed the way I thought about food. And it really made me very nostalgic for the flavors of my childhood and wanting to share those stories as a different way of connecting with people. And so I really just ended up writing a lot and starting my publication Peddler in 2017 as a way of really leaning heavily on those memories and that feeling of nostalgia and the connection that that can bring you. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't end up having that same delivery, you know, that amazing community delivery business that I thought I would coming to Brooklyn, but I still think I have a very strong community, just a different kind of community, if you know what I mean.
Well, what an incredible journey, Hedy. Cross oceans and with so many different projects. All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with more Feast Meets West.
This episode is brought to you by Yolele, a revolutionary African foods company based in Brooklyn, New York. Yolele was founded by Senegalese chef, activist, and cookbook author Pierre Thiam. Yolele creates income opportunities for smallholder farming communities, supports their sustainable farming practices, and shares Africa's ingredients and cuisines with the world, starting with Fonio. Fonio is a delicious, nutrient-dense, gluten-free ancient West African grain. Fonio is also drought-resistant, so it's good for the planet. Yolele is creating a market for Fonio and other African crops grown under resilient farming systems to foster a more biodiverse, drought-tolerant landscape across West Africa. Try Yolele's Fonio, quick-cooking Fonio pilafs, and new Fonio chips, boldly flavored with the ingredients and flavors of West Africa. Sign up for their newsletter for recipes, notes from the field, and culinary discourse, and get a free bag of Fonio with your next order of $32 or more. Learn more at yolele.com. That's YOLELE.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Feast Meets West. So Hedy, how did you land on the concept for your latest book, To Asia With Love?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way the books come to me, every single book has come to me just as a almost like a personal yearning, you know, to tell a story. So after I wrote Family, which was my third book, I knew immediately I wanted to write an Asian book because there was, in all my books, there's an Asian chapter actually. But after I wrote Family, and it was kind of around the time I was working, doing a lot of work on Peddler, which is my multicultural food journal, stories of home and stories about Asian food and just that uniqueness of that culture, of Asian culture, it was something I really wanted to talk about and I wanted to share. And I guess, you know, in the very beginnings, I saw it as a book about my homecoming, which sounds weird because I don't live in New York right now, which is, you know, not where I grew up. But I see the homecoming as in these flavors, as in these recipes, of really like revisiting my childhood, the flavors that I love the best, and embracing those. And on the other hand, kind of announcing to the world, look, you might see me as this person that makes salads. You might see me as Australian if you know, hear my voice, but I'm actually Chinese. And I think it took me a really long time to really feel like I was in that place, to really embrace that and to make a statement. And to me, To Asia With Love is that statement. It is me like coming out and saying, I am really proud to be all these things. I want to celebrate that, and I want everyone to know this is what I grew up with. This is the person I grew up, you know, these are the flavors I grew up eating, and I'm so proud of that. And I want you all to experience this generosity in flavor and food. And that's what To Asia With Love is. And I just feel like I've been so lucky that people have embraced it the way they have. People from all walks of life have come to me with just stories of how they feel connected to the stories that I'm telling in this book. You don't have to be Asian to feel the way that I felt, you know, and to feel like to see yourself in these recipes. You can be someone of any walk of life, of any cultural heritage. And so, yeah, this book is really just, it's amazingly personal on a lot of levels. And I don't know if you've heard this from other people you've spoken to, but sometimes it's hard to let go of those recipes too. Mm-hmm. Like it's quite strange to see people making some of these dishes that I grew up with, because they mean so much to me, and they are, you know, they're a part of my DNA, you know.
It's amazing to see these parallels in other people, and then you see that, I didn't just grow up with a steamed egg custard. Actually, swaths of others have, and that feels really encouraging, and I feel like I belong
exactly. Wherever I am. Exactly. I think that feeling of belonging is something that perhaps I've been searching for my whole life, that, you know, and the feeling of belonging is, it's interesting because you don't find it in a place, you find it in people. Mm. So, you know, I think after I wrote this book, I've never felt like I've belonged more than right now. So that's really interesting. And I think that by putting these recipes down, you know, it's interesting to come from a culture that where food is passed down orally. It's not really written down. And so we're of this generation where we want to write things down, you know. So for many years, I thought that a lot of the things that I was eating were unique to my mother. I thought they were unique to our family. I didn't know other people were eating soy dan. I didn't know other people were eating macaroni soup. I thought that was something that my mum made up. I absolutely did. And funnily enough, you're going to laugh, I thought it was a dish that she had made up until about 2 years ago, because I'd never seen anyone write about this dish or talk about this dish. But I went to Hong Kong. I've been to Hong Kong twice in my life, once when I was a child and once 2 years ago when I went back for work. Mm-hmm. And when I was there, I remember I walked past McDonald's, and I like looking at McDonald's menus in different countries. Mm-hmm. And they had macaroni. Yeah, I know. Yes. And they had macaroni soup on the menu.
All your favorite breakfasts.
Yes. And I was like, what is this doing on a McDonald's menu? They stole this from my mom. How is this possible? And then I realized every cafe in Hong Kong that I went into had a macaroni soup on the menu. And so I'm like, wow, this dish that I thought was my own dish, like something that only my mum made, this is from Hong Kong, which is, you know, somewhere she lived for a few years. So that itself was, you know, so eye-opening to me. So to be able to, like, write down those recipes, a lot of people have reached out and said, I can't believe that's in a book, or, you know, I can't believe you talked about macaroni soup in a book, because I think for so long, like, some of these home-style Asian dishes were not talked about in mainstream media. It's not just so many, you know, like the lens of mainstream media for so long was based upon Western foods and European-centric mm-hmm. foods, and the only Asian foods that were given, you know, any space were things like dumplings and noodles. And of course there's dumplings and noodles in this book, but there's also a lot of other dishes that are not so well known. But hey, you know, Asia's one of the biggest continents in the world and is the most populated, and lots of people are eating these dishes. They're just not
being talked about. It's time to write it down.
Absolutely.
And not take it for granted.
Exactly. So, like, even though maybe in America, like, you know, steamed water egg custard is weird to those, you know, people that live in America, for, you know, a lot of people in the world, billions of people in the world, it's actually not unusual at all. It's everyday food. So I think it's been great to provide a different lens for what an mm-hmm. everyday food is. And I think I've done that. I just actually recorded the things that I was eating. and that has resonated with lots of people. So that's been wonderful. And it's also wonderful to have a moment where you're bringing attention to a dish that is not as that has not been, you know, given that much love in the media, and lots of people go, oh, I love this. You know, I would eat this every day, or I could make this and put my own spin on it. And I kind of love that about food, is the way it evolves. I think food always should evolve with every generation. So,
yeah, it's great. I also just love that the recipes are vegetarian. And you make a point in your book where you say there's a myth that there's so much meat in Asian cuisine, but the truth of the matter is that's really just the case in restaurants and not so much in home cooking. Yes. At the same time, you're not shouting it from the rooftops like, oh, meat eaters, beware, this book is only for vegetarians. It's actually really so accessible for everyone, isn't it?
It is. I've had a lot of people say to me they've cooked halfway through the book and then realized it was vegetarian, which is hilarious and just such a win for me. Because
yeah, it's a compliment.
It is, because I've been a vegetarian for a really long time, so going about vegetarianizing the things that, you know, I ate when I was younger has just been a real natural thing for me for the last, you know, 30 years or 20 years. It's been, and so nothing in this book is forced at all. It's just really just the way that I've adapted the things that I grew up eating. I grew up eating, before I turned vegetarian when I was 19, I ate everything, you know, like, and that means, you would know that coming from a Chinese family, we eat, like, you know, pig's intestine soup as a normal everyday meal, tripe as a normal everyday meal. I'd eaten everything. So the joy in that is that I got to experience those textures and flavors. And so much of my adult life has been really recreating those flavors and those textures of my childhood, but, you know, focusing it on vegetables. I really never, ever since my first book, I've never harped on or shouted about the fact that my books are vegetarian, because for me, I want food to be inclusive, and I believe that my recipes are incredibly inclusive. And so I think when you put labels on food, like things like vegetarian or vegan or gluten-free, I think it a lot of people think that they're missing out on something. But what I think, the way I see my own food is that it's, you're actually not missing out, you're gaining. You're gaining so much in texture and flavor, but also in knowledge. And so I think that, yeah, the labels aren't important to me in the food. It's more about the stories of the recipes.
Yeah, I love that philosophy. So you've now lived in so many different major cities. What's next for you and the family? Where do you see yourself in 2 or 3 years from now?
That's a good, really good question. I really don't know. I don't see us leaving New York for a while, actually, because we got to this stage living here where our kids started getting older. And so they're very much entrenched in their lives here, you know, with school and everything. So I think now that's going to really, like, determine how long we're somewhere. But, you know, I think I really love New York. It's a hard city to live in. And, you know, from the perspective that it's expensive and it's competitive and, you know, I'm going more, and, you know, competitive for the kids, you know, in terms of going to school, they go to public school here. And it's a real rat race, you know, it's like you're constantly hustling but on the flip side of that, there's a lot of opportunities, and I like the person I am here. And I mean that in that I work really hard. I feel very creative. I'm always inspired by things when I'm here. I love the friends that I've made here that have become like family. Friends that are from also, you know, transplants from other cities.
Right.
And it's just this different, it brings out a different mode of storytelling in the way I write about food. And I like that. So I guess I'll be for the foreseeable.
That's great. We'd love to keep you here, Hedy.
Maybe forever, but who knows?
Yeah. So speaking of work and, you know, other creative projects, what else are you working on? I mean, you've done so much already with the books, and you have your own podcast and the Peddler magazine as well.
Yeah. So Peddler is this, you know, beautiful, wonderful experience that is always there in the background. My wish in life, my ambition in life is to bring Peddler more into the forefront of my work. Mm-hmm. I feel like in the last few years, you know, I really do see myself as a professional kind of cookbook author, I guess, because I'm always working on a book. I feel like in the last, you know, 5-6 years, like, there's never been a time where I haven't been working on a book or promoting a book or, you know, something like that. So it takes up a lot of my time, but in the last few years, Peddler has been this wonderful kind of diversion that I have once or twice a year. We put out one or two issues a year, and it's just a really different mode of storytelling when you don't have any commercial pressures and you can basically just tell the stories whatever you want, you know, within a theme. And it's amazing to work with a lot of young writers, a lot of first-time writers, all from different backgrounds. And I'm really proud of the work we've done in terms of working with actually 100% women so far. We didn't start out as a women's magazine or a magazine just for people from different cultural backgrounds. But that's the way we've ended up. I mean, there's a lot of Asian voices which we who we work with. There's a lot of voices from all over the world, and we just it's a real kind of high point in my career to have established that magazine, to have given a voice to so many different people, and then we started the podcast. I guess it was 2 years ago. We've had two seasons, and we've only done one season a year so far, but that's a different. It's been such a fulfilling way to tell stories, as you know, like the audio stories, and connecting to people through voice is a very different way of telling stories. So we are working on the next issue of Peddler, which is probably going to be out in the fall, and also the next season of the podcast, which we haven't started yet, but once we start we do it quite quickly. So there's always, you know, it's interesting to see. I always saw the books as commercial because they have to be commercial. You know, books have to appeal to a large audience. And I always saw Peddler as like this independent little project that didn't have to appeal to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting into 2021 to see those two worlds converging, because I do believe they actually are. You know, like Peddler started off as real, and it still is just real kind of personal narrative, without, you know, having any constraints. And now I see, and To Asia With Love is definitely as far as I've gone in a book, in real personal narrative and telling a very small story. And I do see those two worlds converging. So that's a really interesting kind of insight into the world of food media in 2021.
That's great. You're basically trying on all the hats, and now you're playing a editorial role as well. And it's so exciting to see you flex your muscles and food storytelling in different ways.
Yeah, thank you, Linda.
Yeah, you're an inspiration, Hedy. Thank you so much for chatting with me. For our listeners, where's the best place to purchase your book?
Well, To Asia With Love is available everywhere. It is, at your local bookstore, and always support your local bookstores. I mean, that's been a really huge part of the last few years, since I've had books coming out in America is really kind of, you know, supporting those indie bookstores and bringing the bookstores back. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, everywhere.
That's great. And you must be active on the grams and social media as well. Where should we follow you online and across mm-hmm. your various projects?
Yep. So my Instagram is just at Hedy McKinnon, and you can find my work at Peddler at Peddler Journal. And I have a website, which is, it's still my old website, actually. So it's www.arthurstreetkitchen.com.
Sounds great, Hedy. We'll be sure to follow across everything.
Oh, thank you so much for having me today. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, Linda.
Thank you.
And that's it for our show. Thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. We truly appreciate your support, and it would mean so much if you could leave us a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another conversation from the world of Asian food.
Feast Meets West is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.